Well, thank you for having me. This is a real delight. I don't know if you've heard of Biola University before. It's a 110-year-old educational institution in Southern California, in Los Angeles. In fact, Biola stands for Bible Institute of Los Angeles. That's how it started. There's a very famous Bible Institute in Chicago called Moody, and Biola was formed to sort of mimic or rival Moody. And so it's 110 years old. Now, that's a big deal in the Hollywood, Los Angeles area. To have something 110 years old is really remarkable. We tear things down quickly there and rebuild them if they get, you know, past 40 or something. And, I mean, I don't think we have anything other than, some aging movie stars that are 110 perhaps. But that's about it. So it's impressive. So I've been at Biola for about 20 years. I can't believe it's been that long. But when I first got there, I fell in love with the students there. It was a doing wonder bunch, a Jesus-loving Bible-reading bunch, but really smart and doing wonderful work. My colleagues, they told me how to basically spy on the students, though. They'd wired the campus for this new network. It was just an internal to the campus called BUBS, the Biola University Bulletin Board System. And so you could actually tune into this thing and watch the conversation the students are having. So if they're planning a sneak attack in your classroom or something, you can actually know about it in advance. So I'm watching the discussions they're having on this big electronic bulletin board, and I noticed one fellow has set up a contest for the, but I got a theory on anything. Well, that's pretty wide open. So I thought I gotta watch this over the next couple weeks and see how this pans out. So students are posting their entries, and they're hoping to win the Starbucks coffee gift card. Yeah. And so these are very fascinating, the things they're posting. But then this fellow finally announces the grand prize winner. I was so taken with it and the Biola students that I printed it out. I carry it with me to this day. Here's the grand prize winning theory on the best theory on anything. It's in the field of thermodynamics, which is especially impressive because Biola does not have an engineering school. But here's what the student writes. In the subject of thermodynamics, the best theory on anything. He writes, when a cat is dropped, it lands on its feet. And when toast is dropped, it always lands buttered side down. I propose that we strap giant slabs of hot buttered toast to the back of 100 tethered cats. The two opposing forces will cause the cats to hover, spinning just inches above the ground. Using a giant buttered toast cat array, a high-speed monorail could easily link Los Angeles and Palm Springs. Well, that was the hours off of our travel time during spring break vacation, you know. Well, that was it. We don't have an engineering program, but we do have a wonderful creative writing program, as you can tell. But I fell in love with the Biola students at that moment. So it's been a wonderful 20 years. I started this master's degree program in Christian apologetics. If you're unfamiliar with the term apologetics, it is kind of archaic and ancient and difficult to rejuvenate in the modern world. But it really just stands for offering reasons for faith. I've put my faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Are there any good reasons to do that? Or is it just some sort of blind leap action that we take? And so apologetics seeks to justify this step of faith, a step of trust towards Jesus through good reasoning and good evidence and that kind of thing. In other words, it turns out we think Christianity is really true, and the evidence really ought to back that up. That's what it's all about. The great apologetics verse, you've probably heard this dozens of times, but it comes from 1 Peter 3:15. Peter writes, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. I really like that gentleness and respect part. That hasn't always been done that way. I actually studied under some guys who were maybe a little bit less gentle and respectful. This was an age when people would maybe in America turn out for a big apologetics debate. There'd be a Christian theist against some atheist or skeptic or something, and they'd have a major debate over a big question, does God exist? did Jesus rise from the dead? And so people would enjoy the back and forth of the debate, but then afterwards people would leave the auditorium and they'd be discussing what took place in front of them, and the discussion would go something like, well, you know, I think that Christian guy won the debate. But honestly, after seeing his behavior, who would want to be one? Oh, you know. So we don't want that to happen. It's apologetic. It's gentleness and respect part. And I hope that's always a strong part of the whole Christian apologetics enterprise. And Kevin Moss was a received the Master of Arts degree in Christian apologetics. And we're just thrilled with what he's doing with all that highfalutin education he's got. But it's a unique kind of program. It's actually been part of the Christian faith since the very beginning. Even Jesus engaged in apologetics, but it's been lost and forgotten, thinking that it's really not an important area, but it is, and we need to get back to that. Well, it's great to be here, and you look like a friendly bunch, and that's good. I go to a lot of places that aren't particularly friendly. Very secular university campuses where you really can't, it's very difficult to give a really thoughtful Christian oriented lecture on something on a modern campus. It's really not a big open place to discuss ideas anymore. It's rather rough sledding to go into these venues. It reminds me of, this is a few years ago now, maybe five or more years. I went to a campus in the state of Washington. It's in the Pacific Northwest. And Washington State is thought by sociologists to be one of the most unchurched places in the country. If you go into Washington State and ask a Washingtonian, where is the most unchurched or secular place in the state of Washington, they immediately know what that is, and that would be Olympia, which is the state capital. And there's a couple of colleges in Olympia. And so if you go to a secular campus in Olympia, Washington, presumably you have landed at spiritual rock bottom in America, you know. So imagine my surprise when I get a call from this campus in Olympia, Washington. There's a couple of Christian students who have started a club, a Christian club on a, this is a radically secular campus. This is, it's very hostile territory. So I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how could they have started some official Christian club? Well, turns out it wasn't much of a club. It was just these two guys. And they were business majors, and they discovered that if they start any kind of club whatsoever, they get access to the pool of student money, you know. And so literally they just give them handfuls of cash to go about and spend as they will, you know, to move this club forward. Well, they were thrilled by that, and the only thing they could think to do is to invite up some of their favorite Christian speakers and writers to the campus. You know, I don't know how much money they had, but I was their guinea pig. So they called me in my Biola office. Once I heard what they were doing, I said, yeah, I'll be happy to be your guinea pig. And it's through the nature of this campus, I thought, these guys are going to be lucky to get two other people, and it's not going to be much of a lecture. So we set it up. They bought me an airline ticket. I flew up to Washington State. They picked me up at the airport in Seattle, and they were gunning it down the interstate highway to Olympia. They were late for the little event that they had set up. So they pull into a college parking lot. They get me out, and they hustle me quickly into a building. I walk into the building, and as the door is closing behind us, I look up here, and on the wall of the building is a poster. It's about yay big. And it's my face. I mean, this is a really disturbing feeling. You walk in and you go, oh, goodness, you know, there's your... But it's not just my face. There are flames under my face. And the theme of the talk is actually on the poster, which was new to me. It was called Come Barbecue the Christian. So it had, you know, fire because they were going to roast me in some terrible way. The moment I saw the poster, I saw a fellow walk by me with a wheelbarrow full of barbecued chicken wings. They were covered in foil, but you could get the smell coming off. I guess they were from the best barbecue place in town. And he's walking down the hallway, and he turns into a room. Well, we walk into that same room, and the smell is filling the hallways in this college building. Turn the corner, walk into a lecture hall. It's standing room only. There are undergraduate students and graduate students and people in, you know, white lab coats fresh out of the lab. There are janitors in the room. There are people's mothers in the room. You know, it's just word had gotten out. And this is going to be great fun. You get to barbecue the Christian or roast him, you know, over the spit, and then celebrate by eating chicken wings from the best place in town. This is a really hot ticket. So I'm trying to get my mind around this. You know, I thought I did come prepared to give a talk and maybe answer some questions, but this was just going to be wide open, an open forum Q&A. So the fellow you organized it, he hadn't really thought all this through, but he just stood up in front of the group and said, okay, so here's what's going to happen. You're going to ask questions to that guy for an hour, and then we're going to give you wings. And he sits down. That was it. And so I just gave kind of a quick 5-minute opening talk off the cuff and said, all right, let's hear your questions. I've been doing this a long time, by the way, and the questions have changed over time. They've changed. The questions have gotten stupider, you know. Not to be mean to people asking the questions, but it was kind of tragic that these students, when they would ask a question about Christianity, almost all of them had gathered all of their information by reading the Da Vinci Code. So it was just a little bit pathetic, you know. I mean, I could almost cite chapter and verse in the Da Vinci Code when their question was being asked. And the whole atheist club was sitting right in the front row with t-shirts on so that you couldn't miss them. And I had to help some of those guys ask better questions. You know, one guy was having trouble. He says, well, you know, clearly you can't believe the Bible because it's been translated so many times. What does that even mean? What do you mean? It was written in Greek and then somebody translated it maybe into Latin and what, Japanese? Clearly this has been in Dutch? Is that? And he's like, and he didn't know the nature of his own question. Clearly this is one of those questions he just heard along the way and thought it was going to be a real stumper, you know. But I didn't even understand it, you know. What he really probably meant was it's been transmitted and recopied over the years and maybe some mistakes have wandered in. So I said, maybe that's what you mean. He goes, yeah, that's what I meant, you know. And so I answered that question. But so it was kind of strange in that way. But even stranger, about halfway through the event, the questions just dried up. They're just staring at me, and I'm staring back at them because I know they have to ask questions in order to earn the wings. So I'm just going to stand there for them. And this strikes me as crazy because this is an open forum. With food and such at a secular, you know, institution of higher education with young minds trying to wrestle with the big questions of the day. And the questions dry up. You know, that seems like a bit of a tragedy. This is your chance to ask the big question. So I'm sitting there just staring at them. And I saw a fellow out in the crowd and he's nudging his neighbor. And because it's the only motion, I'm actually focused in on it. And I could read his lips. He's basically saying, ask the question. And his partner's saying, okay. And so he sheepishly raises his hand and I immediately call on him because it's the only thing happening. You. And he's like, whoa, well, so like, we say like a lot in the U.S. So do you believe in baptism? Well, that was a strange question. I said, sir, not only do I believe in it, I've seen it done. So there's this pause, you know, and then the whole place starts laughing, you know. And thank you, G.K. Chesterton. I stole that from that famous Christian writer. It's a great line. But the whole place just started laughing, and you could just tell once they started laughing, they started to sit back in their seats a little bit and relax. Of gotcha, like the shields were going down. It, you know, suddenly it wasn't a game of gotcha. It just felt a little more relaxed. And after that, they started asking me questions that were actually, you know, more to the point. Like, I remember one guy, one of the first questions after that was, so really you're like a Christian and an academic person? I mean, help us understand how those go together. You know, it really mystified him. But that's an opportunity to talk about what I really wanted to address. And other questions like that. One question said, did you grow up in a Christian home? You know, no. Were you dropped on your head as a child? You know, But these are real questions, trying to understand the whole journey, you know. A few people even gave me some wonderful Christ had done gospel softballs, you know, where wonderful entrees to presenting, you know, what Christ had done in my life and so on. So overall, it was a good time. I wish that last portion had lasted longer. But then they released them to the wings, you know. But this was kind of a sanctimonious crowd. They were asking some very holier-than-thou questions, you know, like, you know, and criticizing me. But then when it came to going to the wings, oh my goodness, you know, people in walkers were being trampled and they were, not quite that bad, but they're all rushing to the wings, you know, endangering, you know, innocent people along the way. And once they got there, oh, clearly there were a lot of architecture majors or them literal engineering majors in the group. The reason I can tell this is because they gave them little plates, but they were able to build towers of wings, you know, with flying buttresses for support and drawbridges. But they had these mountains of wings. I remember being impressed by how they could balance it all. And so this had a very strange ending. I remember they were over getting their wings. Somebody in the front row right here wanted to chat, so I'm leaning over talking here, focusing. I've learned to use my peripheral vision on secular university campuses, so you really do need to know what's coming at you. I'm talking here, and I see Sue's head, the wing table, coming round the bend, you know, kind of left my vision, and they're coming around. I knew somebody was heading for me, and there was a woman with a giant pile of wings, and she was eating one. And she had some schmutz on her face here from the wings. And she's walking at me like this, you know. She gets to me. She leans over me while I'm still talking to the other person. And just goes, hey, hey. And I look up and there she is right there, you know, kind of in my personal space. So I'm kind of backing off. And she's waving a wing at me. She goes, all right. She goes, here's my thing. There aren't enough women in the Bible. Like, I'm in charge of that, you know. You know? So I'm thinking sent in. She's a spy or a plant from the drama department, maybe sent in to torment me, you know. So I actually thought that, and I started to return the conversation. I go, oh, I totally know what you mean. And she goes, yeah? I go, yeah, like, say the three wise men should have been the three wise women. And she's like, yeah. I said, that makes so much more sense. If it was three wise women, they would have arrived on time, right? And for goodness sakes, they would have helped clean the stable and deliver the baby. And they would have brought practical gifts like a baby blanket and a pacifier, maybe a casserole, you know. And she goes, yeah, yeah. So what's, you get it. And she walks away. So what's the point of this story? I don't know. It's just fun to tell. But actually, there is a point, and here's the point. What in the world are we afraid of? So I go to, like, ground zero of secularism in North America, and really that's the best they can do. Now, I'm sure they could have found some brighter antagonists and so on, but by and large, that's what it's like out there. It's just kind of crazy. It's hard to find ways to think clearly about big ideas, especially ideas about God and salvation and our souls and what's really real and what's eternal, what's true and good and beautiful. It's hard to get at those things. I just found it wonderful to go onto these campuses and start to talk like that. And it really does kind of blow people's minds. If you can do it with gentleness and respect, we're in an age where you present the gospel and give a thoughtful, gentle response. People find it completely refreshing. You know, like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. Now, I did my doctoral work in religious studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. By the way, my wife's very glad I chose UC Santa Barbara to go to school. I mean, I could have ended up in some, you know, cornfield in Iowa, but I ended up, you know, and they're most beautiful places in the United States, Santa Barbara. And they have a wonderful university there, and their religious studies program was known around the world. And so I was very lucky to get into the program, but I got a chance, and I went in as a Jesus-loving, Bible-reading Christian, you know, but I was always curious about all the other religious options on the table. What about Buddhism and Islam and Mormonism, for goodness sakes, and Hinduism and so on? There's so many others. I was just curious about them and how they would measure up against Christianity. So that's where I actually did a master's degree and a doctorate in comparative religions, and it was a great experience. And not many Christians get an opportunity like that. I think there have been one other Christian in the graduate program, and it was a big graduate program. But you know, he never said a word about his Christianity. I found out, you know, through the back doors about his Christianity. I have many stories to tell about my experience at UC Santa Barbara. It really was a rich time on the edge, and God was with me every step of the way. So it was great fun. I'd love to tell more about that. In fact, I have a whole section in a new book I wrote on my time at UCSB. The new book is called Fearless Prayer, and just coming out in just a few days. But it just talks about how God was answering my prayers so often. And it just seemed to be that I was on the, when we're on the edge of any answers of ministry, he seems to really show up in wonderful power. And we see so many answers to prayer. It's like he really wants to encourage us to do that kind of work. So I got a chance to study all of these great religious traditions. And here's my conclusion, right? Not everybody's going to get a chance to do a doctorate in comparative religion who happens to be a Jesus-loving, Bible-reading Christian. So here's the conclusion. You ready? Here it is. Christianity's weird. There, it's been said. No, if you're a Christian, we signed up for a strange one, we did. I mean, if there's a box called religion, all right, here's the box called religion, and you try to drop it in, awesome, it doesn't go in the box. It's a really bad fit. Now, you can get a saw, and you can saw some pieces off and maybe push some more, but it's a terrible fit for the box. It's like a cat. Have you ever tried to put a cat into a small box? You know, here, kitty, you know, it won't go in the box either. I'm really not into abusing cats. I just make lovely examples. But that's the nature of Christianity with this category we call religion. When I began studying in some depth, the world's great religions, from great scholars in the field to people who practice these things on the ground, I just noticed some dramatic differences between those religions and Christianity. And that's what I want to spend some time highlighting. In my view, Christianity is set apart in rather dramatic fashion from the other great world religious traditions. And so I want to highlight some of the things I found that really set it apart. And I found this very helpful because one of the questions people are going to ask you, and they certainly ask me on a regular basis, it's not even a question. It really is just a basic assumption that they're walking around with. Like, there's a whole bunch of religions and basically they're all the same. If you really boil them down, they're all really about blind leaping into whatever system that tickles your fancy. That's what they're thinking. That's the assumption they're walking around with. So if you can paint a picture that shows, you know, I actually chose this one because it's set apart in dramatic fashion and it really seems to have a better shot at answering all the big questions of life. And so that's how this fits into the general apologetics context. Let me hit you with the first one right away. The first reason that I think Christianity is set apart from the pack, and it's this. Christianity is testable. It's testable. Now, what I mean by testable is that you can offer evidence for it, you can offer evidence against it, and the evidence actually means something. In other words, based on, you can actually make a decision to be a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ based on the evidence of the case, right? Maybe you're thinking, okay, but are you sure that can't be done with other religions? No, it really can't. It really doesn't end up panning out that way. Now, some religions are upfront about the idea that they are not objectively testable. Zen Buddhism would be a religion of this sort. The Zen Buddhist would think I'm a bit loony for, you know, talking this way about religion because it's really not the thing that's going to be most helpful. What's going to be most helpful to a Zen Buddhist is practicing, you know, as guided by a master, hopefully, you know, in meditation and Zen practices, to move inward on an inward basis closer to enlightenment. That's what's most important to a Zen Buddhist. It's not about whether the Buddha really existed or whether he taught his Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path and the Deer Park in Benares. None of that really matters. What matters is, are you sensing that you're moving closer to enlightenment? And so this hyper-focus on historical detail seems completely out of sorts in the pursuit of enlightenment through Zen Buddhism. Some religions sound like they're cool, but once you poke and prod and ask a few hard questions, it turns out they're not. I don't know if you have Latter-day Saints over here in the UK, and maybe you'll see them riding their bikes around, their white shirts and the black name tags. It'll say Elder so-and-so, but he's like 19 years old, you know, so... So we have the missionaries come by our house on a fairly regular basis. I can't believe that, but they, you know, my house is not the right house to go to if you're a Mormon missionary. It's just not, unless they want to find a great deal of fun challenge, you know. I could spend the rest of the night just telling stories about that. I have this strange Mormon, attraction. I'm like a magnet to the missionaries. I think it's because I look like a Mormon. Now, people always laugh at that. There must be some weird truth to that, but So Mormonism sounds like it's testable, but then when you ask some hard questions, it turns out it's not. And I've had this kind of experience with Mormons at every level. Missionaries at my door, bishops of local wards, professors at Brigham Young University in Utah, and even apostles in their church. I've had contact with all of them, extensive contact with all of them, and all of them do about the same thing. So if the missionaries come to your door and they knock and you open the door and you start up a conversation. Now, let's say you studied up on the Mormons. And so you wanted to give them a good run for their money when they came by next time. And so you were prepared. And so once they gave their missionary lesson, which had things like Joseph Smith was a Latter-day prophet. And as a young man, he saw God the Father and Jesus, you know, hovering over him in clothing as bright as the sun. And not too long after that, the angel Moroni, told him to go up in a local hill and dig, and he would find some gold plates upon which were etched Reformed Egyptian characters. And that Joseph, as a new prophet, would be able to translate these things by the gift and power of God, and thus coming up with the Book of Mormon. And they'd probably relate a question number of other historical items to you. And you're logging this in and thinking there's a lot of good questions to be asked about this. And so once they're done with their lesson, you ask those questions. Maybe you ask about the nature of the Reformed Egyptian language. Like, do we know about that at any other place on earth at any time? You know, and so forth. What happens when you start to ask questions like that? At every level, Mormon missionaries or apostles in their church, they take a step back at that point and say, you know, you're asking some good questions. We don't really know some of the answers to those, but you have to understand something. I've had a feeling in my heart that this is true. You know, classically it's called the burning of the bed. Like, you know, I've had an inner feeling that this is true. So it sounded like it was objectively testable. There's a lot of facts on the table, but those facts get pushed aside when it comes to asking hard questions, because it's really about the experience the Mormon has had. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of, like, inner experience from God. Man, bring it on, Lord. You know, I'll take as much as I can get. And Christianity is a rich source of such inner experience. But Christianity doesn't leave it there, does it? It turns out Christianity is true whether I've had an experience of it or not. Christianity is true whether I believe it or not. That's what I mean by subjectively true. You can actually go into the public square, do the kind of research, and come up with some serious answers. Christianity is wide open to that. Now, maybe you're not convinced yet. So let me do this to convince you. Let me read to you what I would consider to be one of the strangest passages in all of religious literature. You're not going to find something like this in the Bhagavad Gita, or the Buddhist Tripitaka, or the Quran, or the Book of Mormon. This comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15, starting with verse 12 and going to verse 19. Listen to this. I'll read this to you and see if you can figure out why I would call this one of the strangest passages in all preached of religious literature. The Apostle Paul writes this, "But if it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith." Really? He continues, "More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. But he did not raise him if, in fact, the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And if Christ has not empty raised, your faith is futile." Empty, worthless, of no account would be synonyms there. "And you're still in your sins. Then those also who have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied." Now, why would I call that one of the strangest passages in all of religious literature? Was he crazy? You know, this is madness. If you're out starting a new religion, this is not the way you do it. Did you see what he did here? He basically hung Christianity by a thread. Right? The thread of the resurrection. And he invited people to come along and try to snip it. You know, if Jesus did not come back from the dead, boom, the whole thing comes crashing down. Now, it does turn out that that thread the Apostle Paul is hanging the resurrection, or hanging Christianity from, is made of some super titanium alloy that breaks any pair of scissors that gets near it. It turns out, in my view, the resurrection of Jesus is one of the best attested facts of the ancient world. I think we can know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus really was alive at point A, dead at point B, and alive again at point C. I think we can know that. And not just through some spiritual feelings, but through the facts of history. I think we can know that. One of my favorite things to talk about on secular university camps is the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Because it blows people's minds. They think there is none. And that's just the assumption they start with. And so when you lay out the case, you go, wow, there's something really going on here. And it's dramatically different than something you find in other great religious traditions. So if you're going to start your own religion, you can say something like this, but you better be able to back it up. It's helpful if it really happened, you know. I remember in grad school, when the lectures would get a little boring, you know, I'd map out my own religion, you know. And it certainly did not include such a thing as this, you know, if this miraculous event which took place in public did not happen, and there's all kinds of people who can come in and testify one way or the other, you don't do that, right? You know, what you do is you simply come up with some great religious truths, you hold them very close in, and you dole them out to people. It helps if you're a little bit of a charismatic figure. You dole them out for large sums of money. That's how you start your own religion. So there, the secret's out. I never did start my own. One of Kevin's professors started his own. Yes, Order of the Magic Unicorn, yeah. So it's really not going that strongly, but we have hope for the future. But I say this just to illustrate the strange notion that somebody would say, if this thing didn't happen, Christianity is simply not true. Go do something else, for goodness sakes. Wow. That just doesn't happen very often. So that's one thing that sets Christianity apart from the pack, in my view, is that it's testability. I mean, you don't have to test it if you don't want to. You can walk in, you know, with your eyes closed, but Christianity is a religion into which you can walk with your eyes wide open, asking hard questions all the way. Now, I think for the most part, Christianity can handle those kinds of questions. It's a nice 2,000-year tradition of doing just that. Well, let me give you a couple of other things that set Christianity apart from the pack. This is a true. In fact, I'll tell you these things by weaving them into a story. This is a true story. It's the first time I kind of explored some of these ideas, and it turned out to be kind of on the fly. I get a call in my Biola University office, and it's a transfer call from the university operator. Somebody from a local community college was calling, they were looking for a fundamentalist. Weird thing, you call Biola University. Hello, I'm looking for a fundamentalist, please. You know, That's just kind of a weird thing. Well, it turns out this fellow Calling was a teaching assistant at a local community college. He was working with the professor and a couple of other teaching assistants for a large course they had going on world religions. It was the very day class. They were getting towards the end of the term, and they wanted to bring in people who could represent the various religious movements that they'd studied. They wanted to bring in a Catholic priest and a Buddhist monk and so on. And they thought, you know, we've got a Presbyterian minister. Maybe we should find a fundamentalist. You know, I'm not sure they knew what a fundamentalist was, but they thought they should find one. So that part's all true. Here's my imagining. You know, I imagine they were gathering together, planning out the end of the term speakers, and they were thinking, we got our Catholic priest, we got our Buddhist monk, we have our Presbyterian minister, but where are we going to find a fundamentalist? And the teaching assistants are looking puzzled, but one of them says, I know, this is probably crawling with them, you know, Biola University, you know, to the phone. And so they rush to the phone, they pick it up and they dial it, and this is, the next part is probably true. The university operator picks up the phone, hello, Biola University, how may I direct your call? Hello, I'm looking for a fundamentalist, please. One moment. It comes to my office. I mean, there's hundreds of faculty members. Now I'm glad that it came to my office. Once I heard what they were doing, I actually wanted to participate. You know, this guy, he just couldn't get off the subject of fundamentalism, though. He thought any conservative Christian or a Bible believer, a real Jesus follower, was some sort of fundamentalist. And I was trying to explain the difference. He wasn't interested. He said, "Do you want to do it or not?" You know. I said, "Okay, I'll do it." You know, I'll give them a lecture on the American fundamentalist movement if you'd like. And he goes, whatever you'd like to do, fundamentalist. So anyway, he said, it's at 8:30 in the morning next Wednesday. Now, the moment he said that, I'm thinking, oh, there's nobody going to be there because this is an elective course at a community college, and students don't like to get up early, so they're not going to get up early for a class like this. Turns out I was wrong about that. The students in Southern California, you know what? They're very excited about their religious options, and going to a community college survey class on world religions is one of the only places they can actually go to actually, you know, formally investigate this kind of stuff and earn college credit. So turned out to be a fairly popular class. Now, so I get there. It was a bigger lecture hall than I expected, and it was starting to fill up already. Now, just as I thought, the students were coming in, and they were looking pretty tired, a little bit bleary-eyed, but they were carrying giant cups of Starbucks coffee, you know. And so I knew it wouldn't be long before that stuff kicked in, you know, and revved them up. So they're settling in, and I meet the teaching assistant, so he greeted me and so on. And I said, hey, I'd like to meet the professor. Is the professor here? And he goes, yeah, he's here. I go, oh, well, where is he? And he goes, over there. It's weird, he wasn't pointing with his hands. He was just gesturing with his head. And so I looked down the line of like desks and chairs. There was a person, looked a little older than the students, sitting at the very end chair with his head down like this. And I go, oh, is he sick? And the guy goes, no. And that was it. And I got the backstory later to this guy. Turns out towards the end of the term, when he turns over his course to guest speakers, he doesn't have any preparation to do. So he'll go out, you know, chasing girls and drinking most of the night. So he comes in and sleeps it off during the class. So he was kind of out of commission. So I was dealing with the teaching assistant. And it was time to get started. So he settled the class and gave me an introduction. Now, you know, we academics, we like our introductions, you know, editor of this, author of that, professor of this, doctorate at this, that's kind of the fun part about being a professor. We just go on and on about our little accomplishments, you know, at each event. And we just love that. So, and this fellow was doing it a little differently. I don't remember what he said. I remember how it felt, right? So this is what it felt like. He said, so this morning you're going to be hearing from Craig Hazen. His education most likely consisted of memorizing Bible verses at, you know, Bill's Bible College and Feedlot, you know. That's how it felt. And so this guy's sleeping it off in the corner. I got this kind of strange introduction from this fellow. And I had these words, you know, I don't know if God ever speaks to me, you know. He speaks to my wife a lot, but not to me. I know if he speaks to my wife, it's something about me, right? No. But I never know if I'm hearing from God directly, you know, but I had this idea, you know, and the idea was, you have free reign here, you know, and I kind of did. That guy's sleeping it off. Teaching assistants gave me a strange introduction, and the students are just waking up from, you know, comas, really. And so I said, all right, students, I'd be delighted to give you a talk on the American fundamentalist movement. But I got to tell you, on the way down here, I was thinking, wouldn't it be fun to take the students on a little journey, you know, to actually give them a talk that helped them to explore all the vibrant religious options that are before them. And that's kind of what I'd like to do. And you can just see that the Starbucks was kicking in at that very moment. They're kind of going, what? What did he say? Oh, yeah, we got to do that. Not that fundamentalist thing. Let's do the spiritual exploration thing you're talking about. Well, all right then. And that guy's still down, and the teaching assistants aren't objecting, so I just surged forward with this. I had really no idea where I was going at the point, but anything was better than giving a lecture on American fundamentalism, you know. So I said this. I said, all right then. Here you are, college students on the campus, and you're studying astronomy and art history and sociology and organic chemistry, all kinds of cool things that really require you to engage your mind. And so how would thoughtful people like you sort through the various religious options to know which one is the right one to choose? And they were getting very excited about this whole prospect. I said, so that's the project here. And let me start by saying this. If you are a thoughtful person and you are on any kind of, you know, religious exploration or religious quest, then it makes perfect sense that you start that exploration with Christianity. Some of you have the exact same looks on your faces that they did. Then I met a guy. He's sitting dead center in the back of the room. He's a typical Southern California surfer guy. He's got long, stringy blonde hair. He's wearing, laceless tennis shoes. And he's got a little skateboard he's holding at his side in the chair. And he raises his hand in some really kind of funny way, you know. And he's the only guy raising his hand, so I call on him. And he goes, so I thought you weren't going to give a lecture on fundamentalism, but the first thing you do is tell us your religion's best. What's that about? You know, I'm thinking, that's not bad. Turns out this guy was actually a lot smarter than he looked, you know. He was sitting next to two other surfer guys who, they actually were no smarter than they looked. But this guy novel. In fact, he was so intriguing to me. I actually explore all of this in a novel. It's called Five Sacred Crossings. And this guy dead center in the background, he actually made it in as one of the major characters in the book. So this guy, I call him Darren in the book. I'll call him Darren this morning. I have no idea what his actual name is, but. So he raises his hand in a strange way, and he makes that comment. And I go, okay, well, hey, that's a good point. I mean, I think I need to back this up. So let me do this. Let me give you four reasons why a thoughtful person on a religious quest would obviously start that quest with Christianity. It's funny. I didn't know if I had four or not. I knew I had two, you know. So come on, Jesus, give me some more. So the first one I gave them was the one I've already given to you. That one reason that intrigues me and causes Christianity to be set apart, and one reason you might want to start your exploration with Christianity, is because it's testable. And I read them that passage in 1 Corinthians 15 and so on. I added one more thing. I said, the good news about starting with Christianity and it being testable is that you can explore it in a finite amount of time, right? In other words, Christianity is making specific claims about Jesus coming back within your, and according to the Apostle Paul, if this didn't happen, you can move on to other things. You're well within your rights, according to the Apostle Paul himself. So I don't know how long it's going to take you to do a careful exploration of the resurrection of Jesus, but maybe it's going to take you 7 hours. Maybe 7 days, maybe 7 weeks, maybe 70 years, but it is in principle explorable or testable. And I go, compare this with, say, Buddhism. You know, there are many different ideas about Buddhism, but I asked a senior Mahayana Buddhist teacher one time, how many trips on the wheel of samsara, right? Birth, death, and rebirth. How many trips does it take before the average Buddhist finally is released, is liberated, you know, into nirvana and so on? And he goes, oh, that would be something like 1 × 10⁶ lifetimes of 60th power of lifetimes. If you're rusty on your scientific notation, that's one with 60 zeros attached to it. It's a huge number, right? And so it makes sense if you're comparing Buddhism and Christianity. Maybe you ought to start with Christianity because you can actually discover whether it's true or not rather quickly, discard it, and move on to something that might take you a little more time. Right? That's the point there. So after that, I said the second reason. There's a reason that a thoughtful person on a religious quest ought to start that quest with Christianity. And the second reason is that in Christianity, salvation is a free gift from God. Salvation is a free gift from God. There's no crawling over jagged rocks for miles to set some offering in some temple. There's no sitting in, you know, arthritis-inducing lotus positions for hours on end. You know, nothing like that, really. He doesn't require any of that. He just gives it to you. And it's really quite remarkable. I read them that famous passage in Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9, where Paul writes, "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It's the gift of God, not the result of works, so that no one should boast." Now, these were college students, so they understood the concept of free. You know, because they're always looking for a free sandwich or a free music download or a free haircut or something. So they really were tracking with me on the free idea. But I don't think even Ephesians chapter 2 really captures the weight of this Christian idea. And I can tell that they like the idea of free, but they weren't really gelling with this yet. So I said, let me give you an example from the words of Jesus. He told this parable in the Gospel of Luke called the Parable of the Prodigal Son. You know, a lot of the students had never heard this before, so it was new. So I gave them kind of my rendition of it, and it went like this. There was this stately father, and he owned a lot of land and a lot of animals. He was a rich man, kind of a patriarch, you know, to his family and even to the surrounding regions. And one of his sons comes to him one day and says, "Dad, I want out of here." Now, he's just a young punk kid. What does he know? But you know, his dad goes along with his request and says, "Son, all right, maybe sells off some land, maybe some cattle or whatever." But he hands this boy a big bag of shekels, and he takes off for a far country. And the text talks about him in the far country. It says, he blew through that money like there was no tomorrow. Wine, women, and song all day long. And when, unfortunately for this kid, when he was about down to his last shekel, a famine, well, actually some terrible weather hits land, a drought, a famine ensues, and it's hard not only to find work, but to find something to eat. So this kid's in pretty bad shape. He's getting a little hungry, so he's even thinking about leaping over the fence and eating the slop the pigs are eating, you know, which is not exactly the plight of a well-heeled Jewish kid back in those days. So the text says he comes to his senses, looking at his dire straits. What have I been doing? And so he just looks at home and he starts taking that long, dusty walk back home. And his dad is sitting out on the porch one day. You can see this is my rendition. His dad's sitting out on the porch one day and he sees a speck of dust on the road near his place. And it's clearly a person walking. But as the figure gets bigger, as it gets closer, the father squints a little bit and goes, "Oh, you know, it's my son." Now, as Jesus is telling this parable, this is where it takes a turn. There's an expectation to those hearing it. And they're expecting this, that the father would snap his fingers, call on his biggest, burliest returns, and say, "Go escort that ungrateful wretch off of my property. Make sure he doesn't return. He's got his inheritance. He can just live with that." But that's not what happens, is it? Instead, this fellow recognizes his son, and in a very unstately way, he leaps off the porch and he runs to him. And he gets to him and he throws his arms around him and he kisses his neck. He puts a gold ring on his finger, a new cloak and sandals. He yells to the staff, you know, "Find the fatted calf and kill it. We are having a feast tonight. My son was lost and now he's found." I told the class at the community college, I go, "I challenge you to find anything like that in any religion on the planet today or going back through history." And I've looked as deeply as I can. Maybe you can find something else, but I've never seen anything like that put on display. The love of God for his wayward creation. And I think that's the case. And brothers and sisters in Christ, I don't think we make enough of this idea of the free gift of salvation. It really is remarkable, and it sets Christianity apart in a dramatic way. So the students were tracking with me on those two things. I mean, they like the idea of, testability. They like the idea of free. And so I thought, I'm on a roll. I'll hit a thought new one. I'm just thinking up right now, The third reason a thoughtful person on a religious quest would obviously start that quest with Christianity is this. With Christianity, you get an amazing worldview fit. You get an amazing worldview fit. What I mean by that is Christianity paints a picture of the world that matches the way the world really is. Christianity paints a picture of the world that matches the way the world really is. And I thought that was a pretty good idea. I had some ideas to explain that. And then skateboard guy raises his hand. He goes, it sounds like now you're just saying stuff. He's right. He was at that point just saying stuff. And he basically challenged me, how in the world are you going to demonstrate that? That's about as broad a statement as you can make. My religion, matches every fact in the world, both seen and unseen, better than others. That's kind of a bold, brash statement. I go, it kind of is. And I even run a master's degree program in apologetics where we try to do that all day long. And honestly, it feels like we've just scratched the surface on it. So that is a good point. But let me do this. Let me bring up one worldview issue that needs to be dealt with because it's something we've all experienced and see how that helps us see if Christianity lines up with the way the world really is or not. So let's take the problem of evil, pain, and suffering, for instance. Evil, pain, and suffering. How does Christianity deal with evil, pain, and suffering? And how do, say, Eastern religious traditions, in general, handle the problem of evil, pain, and suffering? I told them, in Eastern religious traditions, the primary move that is made in dealing with evil, pain, and suffering is to call evil, pain, and suffering maya or illusion. Is to understand its illusory nature and assimilate that idea as deeply as you can. As you assimilate the idea that evil, pain, and suffering in your life is illusion, it will, in some sense, evaporate from your life. And that's how you deal with the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. And so I asked the classes, is that really painting a picture of the way the world really is, or is it something askew? Well, I think everybody in the classroom had experienced at least some evil, pain, and suffering, and so they knew that was a tough pill to swallow. So I made it even tougher, and I said, let me give you an example. Say that the doors open in the back of the lecture hall, and in walks an elderly woman. She's got a shock of gray hair, and she's got a cane, and she walks down the steps of the lecture hall, and she sits right here in front. Well, we don't get classroom invasions by elderly women very often, so we pause and we ask her, "Madam, tell us your story." And doesn't hesitate for a second. She gets up out of the chair with her cane. She comes around and, in a thick Polish accent, she tells this gripping tale of her days as a young girl in Nazi-occupied Poland, where one day German troops come in and start rounding people up in her village. It's primarily a Jewish village. Her family, of course, was all Jewish. They gather them up and they stuff them into a train car about as tightly as they possibly can. And they send this train car off to a camp of concentration of some sort. So it chugs in, and once it gets there, some people have died en route. Some people have just fallen so tight. And if they died en route, their bodies weren't even hitting the ground. They were packed in so tight. So they were tossing some dead bodies off the train when they arrived, but they herded most of the people into a big compound. And there were a couple of smokestacks in the back, and those were chugging day and night. We know now what was going on with those people. A few of the lucky ones got herded over into a smaller camp. Well, this elderly woman, who was just a young girl at the time, got herded over into the work camp, but the rest went to the big compound with the smokestacks. After a period of time, the little girl was separated from her family and her village. She's nearly starved to death. And About that time, really starved. Fortunately for her, the Red Army comes into that region and liberates the camp. But here she stands, nearly starved to death, wearing rags. Her whole family's gone. Her whole village is gone. She's alone in the world. But somehow, she finds a way to, you know, pick herself up. And she walks down through these decades. And here she stands before us today, telling us this gripping tale of the Holocaust. What are you going to say to her? What are you going to say to her? Are you going to say, cheer up, lady. Turn that frown upside down, you know? Just think happy thoughts and the world will be your oyster, you know? You know, maybe that's a little crass, but the idea that you would challenge her experience, that she really went through those things, because to call it something else and maybe try to set it aside or brush it off the table would be a travesty, because she really suffered. And we know that suffering, evil, and pain are real features of human existence. How does Christianity deal with evil, pain, and suffering? Believe it or not, we traditionally have faced it head on. We certainly don't deny its existence. It's real in our lives. But our great calling as Christians in the face of evil is not to deny its existence and hope it evaporates, but to leap down into the trenches with those who are suffering and bear them up in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, who himself suffered dramatically and knows our sorrows and knows our pain. And it doesn't end there in Christianity. We worship a God who has promised one day to wipe away every tear and correct every moment of injustice. It seems to me that's a pretty robust way to handle evil, pain, and suffering. We as Christians don't have the answer to every instance of evil, pain, and suffering. We don't know why one person suffers and another doesn't. God doesn't reveal that to us directly. But we do know why suffering exists. And we know that our rebellion ushered that into the world. But that seems to me to be a way to paint a picture using evil, pain, and suffering of a world that matches the Christian worldview. And I think Christianity really does paint a picture of the world in many instances that really match the way the world really is. So I thought I dug myself out of that one, okay, but then time was up in the class. You know, nobody told me when to stop. And so there was a door over here in the lecture hall, and there were students already opening it and waiting to rush in to get set up for the next class. And so I said, all right, one more for you. The fourth and final reason why a thoughtful person on a religious quest would obviously start that quest with Christianity. And it's this: Christianity has Jesus at the center. The students weren't that impressed by that, so they started to pack up their backpack and stand up. And then skateboard guy hollers out. He goes, oh my gosh, does everybody see what just happened? Right? To play this was a lecture on fundamentalism after all. He simply waited till the last minute to play the big Jesus card. Oh, we should have seen this coming. This class is coming into the room. Everybody's standing up. I'd lost them, you know. And I didn't want him to have the last word, so I just said, wait. What in the world have you people been learning in here? I look down, and the guy still got his head down. You know, what in the world have you been learning in here? I mean, don't you know that Jesus is the universal religious figure? Everybody wants a piece of Jesus, right? Everybody wants to take him and plant him somewhere near the center of their religion. Did you know that? In Buddhism, for instance, some Buddhists I've met go that far. Jesus might very well have been a reincarnation of the Buddha himself. If they don't go that far, he was certainly some sort of bodhisattva who would bring people up to the edge of enlightenment, you know, on a regular basis. In Islam, for goodness sakes, in Islam, Jesus emerges as a figure greater than Muhammad himself. It's very clear that Muhammad's a prophet in Islamic tradition. There's just no doubt about that, but so is Jesus. But in addition, Jesus is a legitimate miracle worker, is born of a virgin, and will stand with Allah at the scales of judgment at the end of time. I'm not sure of the exact score. You can fix me on this, but it's something like Jesus for Muhammad. But the real point there is everybody wants to put him somewhere near the center of their religious movement. It makes sense if you're a thoughtful person on a religious quest to start that quest with the religion that's had him firmly planted at the center since the very beginning. I remember just blurting that. I scooped up my stuff off the lectern and I just walked out of the room. I just kept walking till I got to some picnic benches out near some lunch shack. I just dropped my stuff. And students were filing out behind me, encircling me. This is not a good sign on a secular university campus. Fortunately, they did not throw sharp objects. They had some sharp questions for me, and we had some Q&A, and it just lasted all day. It was like an all-day seminar. We started, you know, how to pick the religion that's right for you. It was really kind of strange. We started out drinking coffee in the morning because it was still morning when we finished. Then pretty soon we were eating sandwiches and eating pastries in the afternoon. So we didn't make it to dinner time, but it was a great time. And I don't know that I made any converts, but they never thought about it that way, that you could really think through in a rational way to discover maybe the way you really ought to go. And then the time you, in my view, anytime you engage the rational mind in a very thoughtful and honest way, Christianity kind of leaps to the fore in terms of all the religious options. And I think that's what happened to a lot of those students. Well, that's all I have for you at the moment. We take a break and you can get refreshed and maybe we can have some Q&A time. Is that all right?
Okay, now I'm going to be in a minute doing the roving mic bit for those of you who've, in the break, fueled by cake, have got some questions to ask. To start off with one that Craig was asked while you were all getting refreshed, and it is in relation to his rather bold claim that Jesus engaged in the use of apologetics. So he was challenged on that, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what he meant.
Yeah, you can, if you use the term apologetics broadly, you can basically, you know, make it mean anything, but in this case, I think Jesus was pretty specific in doing good apologetic work. In fact, I'm in the Gospel of Mark doing my own reading right now, and I'm in a section where Mark really focuses on his interaction with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And it's really quite wonderful to watch his careful technique, you know, in terms of the tactics of apologetics, how he answers the questions, not the actual content of his answer. But the actual content of his answer is pretty strong as well. And so almost any time you see him discussing with the elders, you actually can see a wonderful example of gentle persuasion going on. One thing in particular, he challenged his detractors on, if you had known the scriptures, you would have known of me, you know, and that's a very strong apologetic point. One of the famous apologies is this, and I think this really shows Jesus is not only doing apologetics, but he's engaging in kind of, he's demonstrating the testability of Christianity. He basically says that, well, there's some folks in town were coming by, and they say, "Show us a sign," to Jesus. And to paraphrase, Jesus says, "I'm not going to show a sign to a bunch of rascals like you, except for one, right? Tear down this temple, and I will raise it up again in 3 days." It's a very bold apologetic statement. I mean, either he's going to carry through with that or not. Now, John tells us what that means. He's talking about the temple of his body. It really was a great region. A statement about a demonstration that he was going to give to his region and to the world for all time. The miracles he performed very often were focused on miraculous signs, and some more than others. On one occasion when he healed a blind man, this was really a great sign to the people watching. He didn't mind at that point the word getting out that he was might very well be the Messiah. And of course the raising of Lazarus is a tremendous apologetic endeavor. You know, that the symbol of power call somebody forth from the tomb. It at least demonstrated Jesus was a great prophet calling on the power of God, that he might very well be the Messiah and could very well be the Son of God who had control over life and death. All of these things are. Now, he didn't engage in apologetics the way the Apostle Paul did. Now, the Apostle Paul engaged in healings and so on, but the modus operandi, is his method of operation in the book of Acts, is the Apostle Paul goes to a particular city and he plants himself at either a crossroads or a center of learning, and the Greek text is always saying he dialegomide with the people. Which means it means much more than dialoguing. He engaged in robust argumentation that Jesus really did come back from the dead. Jesus didn't do that exactly because he was in a little bit of a different spot, but I think he laid the groundwork for that. Then, I mean, one quintessential example of Jesus doing apologetics is in John chapter 20, doubting Thomas, right? Strangely, there's a whole bunch of people who'd see, we have seen the Lord, right? And Thomas wasn't there at the time, so he hears the testimonies, and he's not buying it, you know. This is quite the demonstration when Jesus shows up suddenly and to Thomas. So that's Jesus wants him to know. And that's what apologetics is about. It's moving beyond blind faith and saying, we want to know if these things are true or not. So Jesus was very, very concerned about that. Something that helps to demonstrate that Jesus was setting the stage for people to do apologetics strikes me from the words of Peter and the words of John. I remember as a young Christian reading through the New Testament for the first time, I got the feeling from reading the New Testament for the first time that these close followers of Jesus were actually obsessed with the idea that this really happened. They were obsessed with that idea. And you get this easily from 2 Peter chapter 1 and 1 John 1. 2 Peter 1 says this, we did not follow cleverly devised stories, myths, right? When we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ in power, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. And then in 1 John 1:1, John writes, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. And they certainly picked this up from Jesus and wanted to emphasize it, that this stuff really happened. It's like they wanted to take people and shake them. No, this wasn't some weird religious dream or mystical experience I had. We really saw him, we heard him, we touched him. That's what we're trying to tell you. And that is a very strong apologetic attitude, if not a direct apologetic itself. So that's what I would bring up. There's whole books written on sort of the apologetics of Jesus, which go into much more detail on laying this out. Thanks for the opening question.
Right. Who's ready? Who's going to step up with a question? I think a few of you got some. Right. Thank you, Roger.
Sort of following on from what you just been referring to about Jesus' own ministry and the way that he uses apologetics in his dealing with the Pharisees and so on. The question is really, in the public square when we're out engaging with the world out there seeking to share the Christian message, how do you compare proclamation evangelism, as it were, taking sort of a passage or a verse of scripture, John 3:16 or whatever, and sort of bringing that truth out in comparison with this apologetics approach?
Yeah.
Could you just sort
sure.
of... Sure. Thank you.
Good question. Yeah, I run a graduate program in apologetics, so you'd think I'd be a real enthusiast about doing apologetics. I'm an enthusiast about sharing your faith, actually telling people what the gospel is and what the Lord has done in your life. Those are the things that are always the most powerful. And I don't lead with, a defense of Ruth being a Moabitess, for instance. You know, that's not where I start. I simply want to tell them, because people, if you're going to capture them at all, if you're going to intrigue them with the gospel, they need to know that it's been real for you and that it has transformed your life. So they want to hear that testimony. That's always the most powerful thing. But in this particular age, and this hasn't always been the case. In years past, it's been the case that where we can read a Bible verse or actually just tell about our Christian story, and it would have a great impact on people. I think it still does, but I think it's much more likely that they're going to go, but I've heard that. And they usually start with that because they haven't really studied it themselves. But I've heard that the Bible was written by all kinds of people and very late, so it's not really telling the true story about Jesus. What do you say to that? You know, that is so likely to come back at you, and that we have to be ready for that. And that's exactly what Peter's encouraging us to do in 1 Peter 3:15. Be prepared always to give an answer. But leading with apologetics seems a bit wrong-headed to me, but talking about the gospel and its transforming power is a great way to start.
Thanks, Craig. Who's next?
So you talked about different religions and such like and things, and apologetics. A friend of mine's view is, well, you know, that's your God, this is my God, that's his God. And it seems as if there's no longer a sense of anything being right or wrong. So this is my truth, that's your truth, I like Marmite, you enjoy strawberry jam, I'm happy for you, you're happy. So without going through all different religions on a point-by-point basis, how do you move the conversation from, or how do you think it, and therefore moved from relative truth to something that's right, and therefore there's a basis to have a discussion?
Yeah. I did a radio program for a few years, and it's almost like it was a weekend radio program, and almost every other weekend, it was kind of mind-boggling. Somebody would call in and say, so you don't believe in, like, you know, absolute truth, do you? And we'd say, well, you know, I had a partner on the program. We go, well, you know, we absolutely do, you know. And the fellow on the other end would say, well, I think, you know, you have your truth and I have my truth. I think we just need to learn to live with that. And so we would just engage the fellow, the idea that he has his own truth. They go, do you really believe that you have your own truth? Do you know that you have your own truth? I mean, are you certain? Are you absolutely, is it an absolute truth that you have your own truth? In other words, try as he might, he could not escape the idea that he held to kind of an absolute standard about truth himself. And it's an irrational one. It's one that's self-refuting. If I say to you, I have my truth and you have your truth, well, guess what? I have just expressed my truth that I hold dearly and that I think is true universally and absolutely. And so that's the problem with relativism. It's rationally incoherent. We philosophers like to talk about it being self-referentially incoherent. It's self-referentially incoherent. That's the problem. And of course, this leaks out into other issues and in kind of a mindless way, unfortunately. It's really not particularly a great way to argue to say, well, you've got your religion, I have my religion. That's true, but it actually points to an underlying assumption people have about religion that I mentioned earlier, that they really think religion has no knowledge content, that they think it's really about blind leaping. There's no real rational or knowledge content in religion. You can't make a case, an actual or logical case for your religion, because religions aren't that kind of thing, they think. And that's why I say Christianity is a standout, because it actually claims to be that kind of thing, and it actually claims that it stands or falls based on that kind of investigation. So from that standpoint, Christianity is a standout. Now, it might be wrong, but it certainly stands out, and it's worthy of a first look.
Thanks, Craig. Right. Thanks, Gillian. Here I come.
Thanks. If you were talking to someone and they said that they don't believe that God exists at all, how would you go with that in an evangelistic conversation? Because you can't really then go on to, well, Jesus is the Son of God, blah, blah, because you haven't got God in the first place.
That's right. That's an important point in apologetics. You know, I'm not kidding you. 30 years ago when I was doing apologetics, I didn't really have to make arguments for God's existence. Almost everybody I bumped into was fairly certain that some sort of God existed, so you didn't really have to start there. There's a much better starting point. But these days, with the internet and the new atheists and so on, young children are learning arguments against God fairly early, and they trot those out on a regular basis. So it's good that we have some arguments for God's existence. I've gotten to the point, though, if somebody brings that up, they kind of want to just argue with me, and I'm not particularly interested in just entertaining their arguments, because they like to do that. So my colleagues and I very often just say, well, that's just kind of a ridiculous idea that God doesn't exist. And it is, believe it or not, it's a ridiculous idea. And then you can just bring up some quick things that they need to answer. If God does not exist, you need to explain consciousness to me. Help me understand consciousness. You know, generally, if they're coming at you what we call an atheistic worldview, it also entails or carries with it things, naturalism. Naturalism, that there are no supernatural things. There's no souls, there's no angels, there's no deities. There's nothing invisible and real. And so you can ask them a question, well, help me understand consciousness then. See, I can actually make sense of consciousness as a Christian because I worship an eternal conscious being who can imbue consciousness into his creation if he wills to do that. I mean, that makes perfect sense, direct connection. Help me understand what a thought is. What's a thought? Is it real? You know, I'm having them right now, but are they real? You know, but thought. Notice if you come from the naturalistic worldview, a thought can't be weighed. It has no mass, has no charge, has no momentum, has nothing, none of the properties of the physical world. But I got to tell you, I know that it's as real as can be. And so I like to challenge them just with issues like that. Or if you want to challenge them on a moral question, you got to pick a really strong moral question. Otherwise, you'll just be arguing all night over little nuances. So I usually say something like, you have to answer me this. Is it wrong to torture babies for fun? You know, that's a ridiculous question. But really, I know that it's wrong to torture babies for fun. And I have a reason to believe it's wrong to torture babies for fun. I think God thinks there is a God, and he's actually communicated very clearly about such things. And I have a tremendous basis on which to present that idea. Help me understand why you would think, you know, it's wrong to torture babies. Or maybe you don't think it's wrong to torture babies. So there's just some obvious things that they need to deal with that are weaknesses in their atheistic, naturalistic worldview. And so just tossing out some of those. In fact, in my new book on prayer, I actually have 2 pages that highlight about 10 of those. Things that you can, it's weird to have in a book on prayer, but I'm trying to help Christians understand that Christianity really is true. And so if Jesus says he's going to answer your prayers, you can take it to the bank. And so these kinds of questions can actually play a role in giving us greater grounding in our faith. Thanks for that question.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for your input this evening. Yeah. I've got a couple of questions, if that's okay. I don't know if I'll do one now. Yeah. But what do you think in relation to young earth creationism that a lot of ministries teach? Do you think that's a stumbling block in relation to presenting the gospel?
It does make things more difficult. But I take a strange position. I don't really come, I think, hard either way on young earth creationism or old earth creationism. I am definitely a creationist. I think God created the heavens and the earth and all the beings in it and so on. And I don't think evolution is naturalistic evolution is true. And I have a lot of trouble with even theistic evolution. And I think there's a very strong case to be made that God created pretty much as the Bible describes it. I think the ages of the earth might be epic, or the days might be epic periods of creation and so on. But more to the point, I don't find that a primary issue. Actually, no, in doing apologetics or especially not doing evangelism. I actually know some wonderful Christians who happen to think Darwin was right about things, you know. Now, I don't think they're right about that, but I do think they're right about Jesus, and I think they've got it nailed, and so I don't find it the primary thing I go after, but sometimes it can be a stumbling block for them, and so it needs to be dealt with. They think in some way evolution, whether it's naturalistic or theistic, if they think that's some sort of blockage to them understanding Jesus as the Messiah, the Son of God, and their Savior, then it needs to be dealt with.
I guess I only asked the question for, you know, like obviously scientifically, you know, the general consensus scientifically that the Earth is old. It's not 6,000 years old, and it's 4.6 billion. Yeah. And, you know, that's the general consensus. Yeah. So like it can become a stumbling block, I guess, if we present in something as, say, our interpretation of science.
Yeah.
That can, like, there are ministries like Answers in Genesis and others that basically, espouse that, that yeah. like if you don't believe this interpretation, you don't really believe the Bible. And I guess it can become a yeah. stumbling block to accepting Jesus when people say, well, this is our interpretation. This is the only interpretation. It's 6,000 years. And if you don't believe it, you're not really, you know, you're not believing yeah. the Bible. So you know, or if you're a Christian,
tragedy.
You're not a real Christian because you're not believing my interpretation.
Yeah, I think it's more of a tragedy when that becomes the real test for orthodoxy, a certain view of Genesis. In my view, the very beginning of time, God, in his great wisdom, did not give us a lot of data to work with. And so we're doing our very best to make sense of a few fragments of evidence and statements that God makes. So we're trying our best to make sense of that. He also did not give us a lot of data about how things are going to wrap up, you know. A few things, so we know that it is going to wrap up, but we don't know the details, the time, the place, the details, and so on. And so, in his wisdom, he left the very ends of history a bit wobbly in terms of deep and abiding knowledge. But I gotta tell you this, in the center of history, when he sends his son, oh my goodness, he dumps buckets full of evidence and good reason. So in my view, he really wants us to focus on that and hold a little bit more loosely to the other ends. I think we ought to pay attention to them. They're part of God's word, and I think we ought to study them, but perhaps we ought to hold a little more loosely to them. That's how I generally approach that, but sometimes I get pushed and I have to, you know, I have to actually defend a particular one of those positions, you know.
Thanks, Craig. Sorry, my other question was I was watching a clip of J. Warner Wallace.
Yes.
Do you know him?
Yes.
Okay. Cool clip. I came across him, Cold Case Christianity.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm quite new to that, but I saw a clip on social media where he's been interviewed, and he only has a few minutes to answer some questions, which is fair enough. But he's asked about suffering, which is a big, big topic, obviously. But one of the main arguments he makes is that suffering... one of the things we miss about suffering is that we should see it in light of eternity, that our life is like that, and that, you know, it's for building character and et cetera, et cetera. But a couple of points I wanted to ask was, where in Scripture does it say that developing character is held over into eternity? Aren't we changed in the blinking of an eye, so that our character isn't developed in... He was saying, oh, like in 4,000 years from now, our character's being developed. Well, our character surely is only in this life, not for eternity. And also he was saying that, you know, suffering, obviously it's in light of eternity. But for Christians, it is. But for the majority of the world and the people that have ever lived,
yeah.
it's the opposite, isn't it? They have
yeah.
suffering in this life. And the traditional evangelical view is that they will suffer for eternity.
Yeah, I actually struggle with the same question. If we suffer in this life, I think there is some character building going on. But when you think of growth over eternity, it seems like it must be rather small. But maybe there's some real powerful punch if we suffer in this life, God. You know there is carry through to eternity, but I'm not sure how that all works out. I do know there is character growth through suffering in this life. There's no doubt about that. But it does seem to pale in comparison to the time span of eternity in which we'll be living and growing. And it seems like there must be some sort of transformation as we move into the new life that takes place. So I don't know how all that works. Yeah, that's a bit of a mystery I'd like to know more about. So I haven't looked into good theologians and biblical scholars who've taken that question on, but I bet you they've come up with some pretty plausible answers. I don't know what they would be, but that's a good question.
Okay. Uh-huh. Chris.
Hi there. Yeah, a couple of things. You mentioned Mormonism, and we don't get to meet too many Mormons. I've been in around Cardiff as a taxi driver for around 26 years. And, you know, I've not met that many. Compared with Jehovah's Witnesses, we get a lot of those. There's one about a mile from here that's just had a rebuild, and they've expanded their hole there. Just one point. You mentioned John 2:19 about Jesus tear down this temple, and I will raise it again. Now, this, I met with a senior Jehovah's Witness, an area overseer, and this was the verse that stumped him. So you might find, guys here might find that helpful, because some believe that God raised Christ from the dead. But, of course, Jesus in that verse declares that he's going to raise himself. Mm-hmm. So, and he had no answer to that in that. And he goes all around training, you know. So that was just one minor point on John 2:19. But my question is this.
in my experience, speaking to Christians from lots of different churches in the position, opportunity I have, and in various other churches I've met with from time to time, the average Christian or the majority of Christians in churches are not prepared to do apologetics, mentally, as it were. They may have the knowledge. I go to a church where the Bible is very important, an understanding of it, but getting that understanding to other people and answering their questions. And I agree with your point about, you know, what have we got to be afraid of? Because when I've engaged people in the car, I'm sure you'd imagine sort of answers I've had, you know, of people, but it's quite easy to talk to them in that sense. But if you were going to advise church leaders in a church, whether it's a big church or a small church, would there be two or three things you would encourage them to do to make it more likely that their members would engage in apologetics?
Yeah, there's several levels of apologetic education. And I'm a huge fan of getting people introduced to the basic reasons and evidences for the faith, especially young people. Because that's the level I call the inoculation effect in the United States. It really is quite amazing when you get a young person into some apologetic forum, and there's quite a few of them going on in the United States. It's remarkable. You know, busloads of young people come in, and they find it really stimulating. So this is not something that's off-putting to them. It's something that they find interesting and are willing to spend a day or two or 2 weeks doing. But so there's this inoculation effect when they hear a good argument from a really credible source who's really laying out a good argument and using evidence and good reason to sustain it. Now the student may go back to their school in the fall and they may be challenged by the village atheist on their campus and so on, and they don't remember the good argument. You know, they didn't write it down, they didn't bring their notebook to school, whatever. But nonetheless, they go, you know, I know you're talking a lot of trash about Christianity right now, but I got to tell you, I've been in front of some really smart guys who gave some great answers to those questions. I don't remember what they are, but you know what? Those don't bother me very much because I've heard some really smart guys on our team give some wonderful answers. That is a tremendous inoculation effect. And so I love to get young people in front of that. And it really does carry over. There's been some studies done that actually works. Now there's a second level where the student or even an adult can learn some apologetics and turn around and actually use it. This and that, you know? And here's a tidbit I'll give you tonight. I should have given you this in the first 10 minutes because then you wouldn't have had to sit through the rest of it. Here it is. This is such a gem. It's called the Apologetics Golden Rule. And even if you don't know a lot of apologetics, this is just a good technique to use. And this applies to people who you bump into a skeptic or the village atheist, maybe in your family, maybe at work, maybe at school, maybe at the post office, at the football game, whatever. And they ask you some questions. This is a technique to deal with it. And the golden rule of apologetics is simply this: ask of them as they ask of you. Because the moment you hear the question, they find out you're a Christian. I usually use this example, and this seems to resonate with people. You're sitting at work, you're minding your own business at your desk, you were actually reading a Bible during one of your breaks or lunchtime, you forgot to put it back in your drawer, in walks your skeptical coworker, he sees the Bible on your desk, he goes, "Ha! A Bible! Whoa! I didn't know you were a religious person. Ha! Ha! You know what? Good for you. Good for you." Oh, I hate that. Because you know what they mean by good for you. I mean, good for you. You know, you need that kind of thing because you're probably not a person of knowledge like I am. A more scientifically minded person who's not looking for fairies and invisible entities to help me through the day. But, you know, if you need that, more power to you. Yeah. So let's say this happens. Yeah, the Bible. Can't believe it. Do you really believe the Bible? Let's say the coworker asks. What do you say? You're feeling kind of nervy, you know, like, oh, I forgot to read that Lee Strobel book. Oh, if only. But instead of getting nervy and thinking, what are the best answers, take a deep breath and turn the question around back on them. Well, I'm curious, Bob. What do you think the Bible is? And then watch the craziness fly. I'll give you an example of this. I was like 19. I'd just become a Christian, and I was going up to my uncle and aunt's for Thanksgiving dinner. My mom was up there, and probably my brother, my cousins, my aunt, and my uncle. My uncle, though, he was the smartest guy in our family. He had a PhD in physics. He built bigger and better nuclear bombs for a job or something like that, you know. Real smart guy, definitely not a Christian. And he'd heard that I'd become some sort of Christian. So he wanted to, you know, enlighten me over Thanksgiving dinner. I'm only 19. This guy's got a PhD in physics. So we're eating away, and he goes, "Oh, Craig, I hear you're some sort of religious person now." I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Now, like the Bible, you don't really believe the Bible, do you?" And I just intuited the answer. This is where I kind of did, you know, the power of the golden rule of apologetics. I simply turned it around and I said, "You know, Rob, I do, Uncle Rob, I do believe the Bible. I'm curious, what do you think about the Bible?" Here's what he said. He goes, "Well, you know, we actually talk about that down at the office in the lab and so on. I think it's pretty certain that the Bible was mostly written by inebriated monks in the 1500s. And he's dead serious. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, Lord, you have delivered him into my hands, you know? And I just steamrolled him after that with, like, because I was really into the evidence even just after becoming a Christian. And I'm just tossing everything I had at him. And my cousins, they weren't Christians. Anybody cheering me on because their dad would browbeat them about, you know, their own ideas. And they'd never seen anybody take on their dad before. But ask of them as they ask of you. It does two things. Number one, it affirms them because you're asking them what they think about something. And that's kind of affirming. They want to know what I think. They're looking for my deep wisdom. Yeah. Secondly, it gives you time to hear what they have to say and gather intel, you know, gather some information and intelligence so you can ask another thoughtful question, you know, and you could actually command the conversation just by continuing to ask the questions. So there's a little tidbit you can take home and make a nuisance of yourself, Jesus, all the live long day.
Bits to take home are always good, aren't they? Any more? A Matt Bounds question.
Thanks, Craig, so much for the talk at the start. Really like the four distinctives of why Christianity is weird. I just wondered, as you were talking that through, you're saying that applies across the board generally to other religions. Any particular religions, belief systems that are particularly slippery customers when it comes to applying those distinctives and saying, here's how Christianity is different. Any that are just particularly difficult to engage with, I guess, is the question.
I'm a little hard. Yeah. I just want to hear that one more time because I missed a couple of important words.
So the four distinctives you mentioned, and how they apply to other religions, contrasting Christianity. Any particular other religions that are difficult to apply those four distinctives to?
Oh yeah, Judaism is kind of a strange case for the four points that I brought up. Otherwise, I think most of them would apply. But in Judaism, you know, a lot of it has to do with the, you know, we have the long tradition of the Hebrew Bible and then the New Testament and weaving all that together in a coherent theology. If we do it properly, it should be able to fend off these challenges too.
And if I can ask a follow-up, would it apply to other belief systems like, say, the New Atheism, which isn't a religion, but so salvation being a free gift. Can you really engage with something like the New Atheism with that?
Yeah, you really can't in that they just don't have a concept of salvation. It's not important to them. But most religions do have a point where you're an unbeliever and you cross over to become some sort of believer, or you make that crossover into enlightenment. That's a very common feature of most religions. But thanks.
Oh, Ted.
Yeah, could I just bring you back to the word religions again?
Yeah.
What the soul in the Christian faith?
The soul.
Is they very significant? Is there an equivalent of the soul in other world religions, or how do they cope with this consciousness?
Actually, a soul is a very common feature of religion. It's in almost every one of them. It's a very obvious feature. That's why in the modern secular world, when you go to a university, they don't talk about the soul anymore. They'll send you to the neuroscience department thinking that brain studies can tell you about the soul. It really can't. It tells you almost nothing about the soul. You know, one of my best friends is one of the world's experts on the soul. His name is J.P. Moreland, and he's not a neuroscientist. He is a philosopher who specializes in metaphysics. You know, that is reality that is not physical. And he makes a slam dunk case that there actually is a soul. You know, and so we can know that there's a soul in rather strong terms, and it's got certain functions, and it's completely philosophically tenable.
And is that across the religions?
There is one religion, okay, and souls are features of religions pretty much across the board, except for one, and it's a huge exception. In fact, there's a concept in Buddhism called anatman, which is no soul. And so ultimately, you have to understand, you have to come to understand that you have no soul. Now, if I say to you, you have to come to understand and assimilate deeply that you have no soul, one might say, what exactly is understanding and assimilating if we don't have a soul? And then people go, this sounds like it's filled with contradictions. Of course it's filled with contradictions, but that doesn't bother Buddhists, really. It's not that. We have to come to understand that ultimately Buddhism kind of thrives in contradiction. It actually helps the pure meditative process. But ultimately in Buddhism, it's one of the distinct features of Buddhism, especially that separates it out from Hinduism, which has a soul that, again, is encased in a body. It dies and it'll come back again through reincarnation and so on. But in Buddhism, that's a feature that sets it apart from other Eastern religious traditions. And it's a very strange feature. But in my view, it actually makes Buddhism very intriguing. You know, that's one of my areas of study and specialty in grad school because of that.
So what if truth is not important to people, like in Buddhism or in today? Many people don't seem to be worried to make any rational conclusions, but they feel and by intuition decide what is good for them. What do you do?
That I don't know exactly how to fix that. when the culture... Just think of it in terms of spiritual warfare. If I'm the devil, what I want really to do is to have everybody feeling their way to religious truth. Then anything goes. We can't introduce this rational, evidential, objective element into it all. Once that happens, in my view, Christianity kind of stands out and everything points in that direction. So it really does have to be feelings-based. I like to put it in these terms, as I've mentioned already, the idea that we're talking about blind leaping, that joining a particular religion is all about walking out to the edge of some religious abyss of your choosing. You're closing your eyes and you're leaping into it. And it's just about how it makes you feel. That's really the only guide that you've got. That's the biggest problem, in my view, for religion in the world today, that's the dominant view. And people think that that's what Christianity is about too. So we get lumped together with the other religions. And unfortunately, many Christians think that that's what Christianity is all about too. Now, I'm big on just trusting God, sometimes blindly. But it's never without knowledge. When I'm putting my trust in God, to save me in a particular situation, or I'm in some dire straits, I'm just clinging to him, I have excellent reason to believe that he exists, that he sent his son died for my sins, that he came back from the dead, that I can have eternal life. I have knowledge of that. It's not just a feeling. I think we can know that stuff to be true based on the evidence in the case. But that all gives me power and the wherewithal to cling to him in times when I can't see. And so in that sense, I have a kind of blind faith because I stand on a very firm foundation of knowledge that helps me to reach and grab him, even if I can't see the future.
Okay, great.
Given that your field is apologetics, but obviously you're big on the gospel as your main raison d'etre, really, in some respects. What does it look like to move people from an apologetic argument, debate, to conversion? How do you move there? There's no golden bullet, but That's where you want to get to, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and I fall into this crowd. A number of us have been converted by apologetic arguments, and we've never seen it really much different than a presentation of particular gospel. We in fact, being Americans, we'd heard the gospel, so we knew a little bit about that, but it wasn't particularly entrancing us because we had all these questions sitting around. And so, people who were gently and with respect answering our questions and really concerned about us getting those answers, that meant a tremendous amount to us. And guess what? It was simply a tool of the Holy Spirit, just like the gospel itself is, to come and move us in the right direction. So when people go out in their own strength and their own power to answer the questions, I'm here to answer your questions, you know, that's probably not going to go very far. But if they really care about you and want to get you the answers, the Holy Spirit can use it as a powerful tool to move a guy like me to the cross. And so I never usher apologetics out of the realm of just a tool of God. A powerful tool of the Holy Spirit.
Oh, Roger. Yeah. Just a short question. Do you feel that it's helpful to, when people talk about religion, I find that in doing evangelism, that very often, although there are elements and very much a part of our life is religious, yet the message that we seek to share is not religion as such. It's a restored relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Yeah. Do you think it's helpful to, when we're dealing with people who have problems and who are atheistic or agnostic, to sort of bring this point out that we're not trying to promote our religion? Or do you think that it's... Because obviously... in the sense that there are churches and we attend and so on. So there are religious aspects to what we do, and yet the essence of what we have to share is not primarily religious.
Right, I totally agree with you. Religion is a problematic term, but we have to deal with it. It's the word that comes to mind in the public at large. We're going to be bringing it up, and we need to be prepared for that. So if it's not causing a problem, I'll kind of leave it alone. But often I'll simply say, you know, religion doesn't really capture what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about something, because like I talked about earlier, that there's this box called religion, and there's all kinds of religions in it, but Christianity doesn't fit in it very well. And so I find religion a problematic term, because religions have these features, and I'll describe a few of those to them. And I go, I don't see Christianity fitting that mold. So I'm a little uncomfortable using the term religion. So they're addressing the term and its problems can actually be a kind of an entree into the Christian path. So it can be really helpful in that regard. Religion, best we don't use kind of a clever slogan, you know, and it's not a religion, it's a relationship. I think that's true, but I don't think we should use it in a slogan-y way. We can say those exact same things, but stretch it out a little bit so you can say something like that. The Christianity really doesn't fit that category well, and I'm struggling to find another one. And honestly, as an unbeliever, that would intrigue me. What do you mean Christianity is not a religion? Or doesn't fit the category? Help me understand that. You know, I'd find that intriguing as an unbeliever.
Oh. One last one. This is it. Make it brief and to the point.
Craig, for example, on your points that you made, do you think, like, Islam could cover some of the points that you made? Like, so, for example, fitting the worldview. You know, speaking to Muslims, they would believe that, you know, Islam fits the worldview of the world, pain and suffering that will be redeemed one day by Allah, you know, evil and suffering. It isn't a free gift granted in Islam. It is worked, but they would see, even though they don't worship Muhammad, they would see Muhammad as the center of Islam, was seen as the perfect example, you know, a superior prophet to Jesus. So they would, like, everything revolves around how we live, talk, whatever. So have you spoken to Muslims and presented those four points as distinct from their your beliefs?
I don't remember actually walking through all four, but I think along the way I've talked about all four, and I'm pretty convinced that maybe the worldview issue they might be a little closer to, but the rest they aren't. I've definitely discovered Islam not to be testable in an objective sense. It really has to do with just a presupposition that Allah is God, and that Muhammad is his prophet, and that the Quran is the word of Allah. So it just ends there. There's really not an argument that can be made, at least by the average Muslim or even the Muslim scholars I've bumped into. I know there are some Muslim debaters who can make a case for that, but that's just not general how it's approached in Islam. Of course, salvation is a free gift from God. That is radically different. That stands out. Islam has really nothing to do with that. In fact, it's fascinating to read in the history of Islam some Islamic scholars who not only can't claim, they can't even claim to be Muslims because they have no idea how Allah would be seeing them at that given point, you know. And they thought, they basically came to the conclusion that nobody could understand whether they're actually in Allah's good favor or not. But the worldview thing might work. But having Jesus at the center, I'm talking about I guess Islam might fit that in that Jesus definitely is in the mix there. But Muhammad certainly overrides him. So good point that there's a few points that might score with Islam.
Okay, folks, I think it's time to wrap up. Just want to thank this man very much for what he's done for us tonight in the appropriate fashion. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you, Greg.
We'll be drifting away, but if you do want a last word then before he goes, I'm sure that would be fine too. But thank you for coming along. It's been lovely. It really has. Thank you.